Has the original Armistice Day transformed into an instrument of military boosterism? What are the costs of war, not only on the battlefield, but off the battlefield? Can one aspire to a world without war while America's military-industrial complex is dominant? Is militaristic symbolism deliberately inserted into popular entertainment, or is it a natural outgrowth of impulses embedded deep within the Western psyche? This week on the Global Research News Hour, in the lead-up to the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, we mark the occasions of Veterans Day and Remembrance Day with a dissident examination of how societal conventions of honoring soldiers who fight in wars impacts our society. We'll hear a recent interview with anti-war author, activist, and blogger David Swanson, and we'll hear an interview from last year with U.S. soldiers-turned-military critics Stan Goff and Joshua Key. On today's program, support the troops as propaganda weapon? Remembrance Veterans Day conversations with David Swanson, Stan Goff, and Joshua Key. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 6th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The so-called Islamic State, or ISIL, ISIS, is a creation of the U.S. In fact, the U.S. military buildup in Iraq and Syria that the U.S. is leading is a smokescreen for regime change and war operations in Southwest Asia that target Syria, Iran, and their regional allies. The U.S. has been using parallel tracks of engaging these players while it continues to build up the means for war and regime change. This is why mission creep is setting in, and the U.S., along with Canada and France, has been bombing Syria and its infrastructure under the pretext of bombing ISIL, ISIS. The fact that the U.S. and its allies are engaging with Iran or Syria is only a repeat of the scenario of what happened to the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya while the U.S. engaged with Muammar Gaddafi. It built up the means for regime change against him. That comes from the article, What is ISIS? By Mahdi Darius Nazimroya, posted November 4th, originally appearing in TML Information Project No. 34. America's anti-Russia club, NATO, has crept up to the very borders of Russia and demands that Russians be so stupid as not to recognize what the West is doing, as if John Fitzgerald Kennedy had been so stupid as not to have recognized that the USSR's placing nuclear missiles in Cuba in 1962 wouldn't have constituted an aggressive act by the Soviets and thus needed to be blocked. Russians are even more endangered now by the US. Ukraine, after all, directly borders Russia. America's coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of Ukraine in February 2014 and installed a rabidly anti-Russian one there was extremely bloody, and the U.S.-backed ethnic cleansing to eliminate the residents in the heavily pro-Russian far east of Ukraine has been even more so. Even Khrushchev's intent wasn't so aggressive against the U.S. in 1962. This aggressive intention of the U.S. government and its allies, extending to Russia's very doorstep in Ukraine, Poland, and the Baltics, is so intense that U.S. President Barack Obama holds it even higher in priority than he does the war against the international jihadist movement, a movement that's actually funded by America's allies, the royal families of both Saudi Arabia and Qatar. The U.S. now demands that Russia not even try to defeat the jihadists in Syria, which is an ally of Russia, one that's being attacked by jihadists hired by the Sauds and Thanis. As if the request for Russian help by Syria's president, democratically elected by Syrians because no alternative person stood even a chance to hold the country together, were invalid. As if the request for that military assistance doesn't have legitimacy, but the demand by America's imperial president, Obama, does have legitimacy. That comes from the article, EU and NATO Set to Destabilize Russia by Anti-Putin Propaganda Operation, by Eric Zeus, posted November 4th, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. The explosion and crash of Russian Metro jet Airbus A321-200 over Egypt's Sinai Peninsula raises ominous new questions. The Islamic State, IS, has taken responsibility for the incident. In a manifesto, the IS claimed to have brought down the Russian plane in retaliation for Russian military intervention in Syria. Given the amply documented fact that the IS, ISIS, ISIL, etc., is a creation of U.S. intelligence and function as assets and military intelligence fronts of the CIA and Washington, financed, recruited, and trained by the U.S. and its allies, why shouldn't the claims of responsibility be taken at face value? In an era in which false flag atrocities and deception have constituted U.S. foreign policy, it is in no way inconceivable that forces aligned with Washington committed yet another act of terrorism, another act of war, to send a message of warning and/or provocation to Moscow. That comes from the article, The Suspicious Downing of Russia's Metrojet Airbus A321-200, The ISIS is a Creation of the CIA, by Larry Chin, posted November 5th. The Iraqi government has seized two planes of the U.S.-led anti-ISIL coalition member states that were carrying weapons to the Kurdistan region without prior coordination or information of Baghdad, head of the Iraqi Parliament's Security and Defense Commission, Hakem al-Zameli, disclosed on Monday. He noted that a Swedish and a Canadian airplanes were going to fly to Iraq's Kurdistan region, but they were seized after arms cargoes were discovered. Zameli called on the Iraqi Foreign Ministry to question the international coalition in this regard and warn the coalition members to avoid such moves in future. The U.S. and some other coalition members have been supplying arms to different actors in Iraq. During the last year, Iraqi officials have on different occasions blasted the U.S. and its allies for supplying the ISIL in Syria with arms and ammunition under the pretext of fighting the Takfiri terrorist group. That comes from the article, U.S.-sponsored smuggling of weapons. Iraq seizes two planes of the U.S.-led coalition. They were carrying weapons to the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Posted November 4th, originally appearing at the FARS news agency. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Is Veterans Day, or Remembrance Day as it's known in the British Commonwealth, a solemn commemoration of fallen heroes, or a cynical ploy to promote militarism in Western countries? Global Research NewsHour thought it might be instructive to examine this issue with at least one prominent anti-war activist. We're joined right now from Charlottesville, Virginia, by David Swanson. He is an author and activist. He blogs at warisacrime.org and is the director of worldbeyondwar.org and campaign director for rootsaction.org. He's written numerous articles and several books, including Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union, When the World Outlawed War, described by Ralph Nader as one of the six books everyone should read, War No More, The Case for Abolition, with a foreword by Kathy Kelly, and the 2010 classic War is a Lie, which is about to be republished in an updated second edition. David Swanson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so first of all, we're in the lead-up to Veterans Day, or what we in Canada and the Commonwealth call Remembrance Day. And this started as back in November 11th, the 11th day of the 11th month, back in 1918, as Armistice Day, ostensibly dedicated at the time to putting an end to war. And it seems to me we've seen a shift over the intervening period to more of an emphasis away from that, what seemed to be an anti-war sentiment to what we see today as a kind of pro-military boosterism. I guess I'd want to know, first of all, if you agree with that and how and why we saw that shift.
Oh, I completely agree, and I think almost everyone would agree in terms of what the current Veterans Day / Remembrance Day is about. And anyone who knows anything about what Armistice Day used to be would have to agree that there's been this change. I mean, when World War One ended on a predetermined time and date, as like a whistle blowing in a sports match, and people went on killing and dying up to that moment and then stopped, and the armistice was declared on November 11th, 1918, there was widespread rejoicing, and what was then the worst war ever was ended, and peace was come. And those who had hated the war and resisted the war and protested the war and rejected the propaganda joined with those who believed the propaganda, so that just about everybody wanted it to have been the war to end all wars and wanted to ban war. And the peace movement that followed of the 1920s and into the 1930s was much stronger, much bigger, much more mainstream, acceptable, respectable than anything seen ever since. And it produced, among other things, a treaty in 1928 called the Kellogg-Briand Pact that banned all war. That is still on the books. And that was sort of the attitude when Armistice Day was created. And in the United States Congress, it was explicitly created as a day for peace and a day for working against war and so forth. Well, you know, after World War II, with the United States as all war all the time, imperial power in the making, and specifically right after the war in Korea, ended, though it's never formally ended, this was changed to Veterans Day. And Veterans Day has become, as you say, increasingly about celebrating war and creating more veterans as opposed to avoiding war and ceasing to create more veterans.
Yeah, it seems like all pretense of trying to work towards a world without war is just completely gone. It's just taken, you know, pretty much as a given that the wars will be continued, and we're going to continue to, support those who fight for our freedom, so-called. I was wondering, maybe the role of World War II, because that was seen by many, I mean, even to this day, I'd say most people would argue that this is a so-called just war, right? And that, maybe that might have kind of undercut a lot of the anti-war sentiment coming out of the Great War, which seemed to be harder to justify, you know, the war with Hitler and the terrible things that happened then. I wonder if you have any comments about the role of the Second World War in possibly shaking that anti-war consensus.
Yeah, well, first of all, I agree with you that it's gotten to the point just recently where all pretense has vanished, and you have a president who was the first Nobel Peace Laureate to make a pro-war speech accepting a Nobel Peace Prize. Then you have across the political spectrum every member of Congress justifying militarism by one fraudulent pretense or another, but dropping all pretense of working to end war and shut down the war machine, which was, you know, very much the mainstream agenda across many nations back 190 and 80 years ago. And of course, you are absolutely right about the pivotal role of World War II. The United States has been fighting dozens and dozens of small and large wars and military actions since World War II. And as I understand, Michael Moore proclaims in his latest movie, not won a single one of them, and also not persuasively painted a single one of them as moral or just or beneficial or philanthropic or defensive. And yet, when you object to any war, and I've been objecting to specific wars that are happening for years and years now, you are inevitably told, yes, but if you oppose this war, then you also oppose World War II, and you can't do that because that was a good war, and therefore you are wrong. And the logic is very twisted, but it's the defense of, no other institution on Earth is defended because of supposedly having gotten something right three quarters of a century ago. In no other field of our culture or our public policy do we justify something, much less our single biggest expense in the United States, based on the attitudes of the 1940s. And of course, if you go back and examine World War II, not only did it occur in a completely different world with completely different problems and dangers and shortcomings than this one, but it was the furthest thing from just or necessary. If you have some hours, I can go into the reasons why and the behaviors that might have been different during the 20s and 30s, beginning with the Treaty of Versailles and Wall Street funding of the Nazis and on through to rejecting all possibility of aiding Jewish refugees into the conduct of the war, which really transformed war making into something that targets primarily civilians in all-out, morality-free killing, and has left the world in a damaged state, and the United States in an incredibly dangerous, triumphant mood ever since.
Now, as I mentioned, we're coming up on this day, Remembrance Day, Veterans Day. But even throughout the year, there's this sentiment about around the idea of supporting the troops and the symbolism of the soldier as the frontline defender of our freedoms. And I was wondering if you could comment on the effectiveness of a Remembrance Day and Veterans Day and the valorization of the soldier, supporting the troops as an instrument for promoting militarism and dismantling anti-war initiatives.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, it's an obvious propaganda slogan. It doesn't mean anything. If I'm told to support the troops, there's nothing that I should go and do in order to support the troops. It's a mental attitude, and the effect of it is to support wars. By opposing wars, you are supposedly opposing the troops, and by promoting wars, you are supposedly supporting the troops. But of course, the money goes to the weapons makers. The war decisions are made by higher up, and the troops do not benefit from the wars. And you can poll the troops during wars, as has been done, for example, during the war on Iraq, and the majority of them want the war ended. So you are opposing their desire by supporting it. On top of which, you're not providing the troops with reorientation into a nonviolent society, with education, with career, with health care and mental health care or anything, by putting up bumper stickers that say support the troops. And in fact, when the culture moved as far as it has away from any criticism of troops and any criticism of war, you get these crazy reports and analyses like ones I was just writing about today as we're speaking, that examine why the number one killer of U.S. troops is suicide, and why troops are why war veterans in the United States are so much more likely to murder or kill themselves than non-veterans, that avoid looking at war altogether, and so end up blaming the troops' characteristics when they enlisted and their demographic characteristics of being male or white or poor and so forth, and so it. Troops are returning to a society without any sort of help in terms of reorienting into a world where you're not supposed to kill people and you're supposed to relax. And they're being blamed for problems that are actually the result of the hell they've lived through. You can't go and kill and face death and return unchanged. And yet they're returning. And as part of the process of supporting the troops, they are being blamed for their problems rather than war being blamed.
Mm. So you've kind of touched on another point I wanted you to raise, having to do with the costs of war, not just on the battlefield, which is profiled during, you know, Veterans Day, Remembrance Day events, but off the battlefield when they get home, and not just necessarily on the veterans and the veterans' families themselves, but, you know, on society as a whole. On the world. I mean, could you tally those costs of war to our economy, society, planet?
Well, first of all, U.S. and U.S.-led and NATO wars on four countries impact primarily, and I mean statistically almost exclusively, those four countries that they attack. The impact on U.S. troops and the families of U.S. troops and the neighbors of U.S. troops is practically negligible in comparison to, for example, the utter destruction of Iraq, which will never recover, and the 1.5 million people or so killed above the high death rate under the sanctions regime, the absolute destruction of infrastructure and education, the brain drain, the environmental damage, the epidemics of birth defects and cancers. Iraq will never, ever recover. And so to talk about the impact or the costs of that war and to focus on the costs in the United States is just morally repulsive to me. But once you do so, of course those costs, despite being so much smaller, are horrendous and tragic and absolutely unnecessary, and they extend as with the generations of people still in Vietnam and returned from Vietnam to the health of children and grandchildren, and they extend to the family members and neighbors assaulted violently and otherwise struggling to deal with those who can't function and hold down a job and maintain nonviolent attitudes when they come back from a place where they were praised for participating in organized murder. And these are all costs that are absolutely uncalled for. And if you want to help the veterans and I know that many, many veterans who I know, including in Veterans for Peace and Iraq Veterans Against the War and other organized groups, would agree with me on this. If you want to help veterans, stop creating more of them. It's not needed, and the world can't survive it.
Now, you were talking just about the costs of war, but there are benefits, or at least certain players who benefit from war. War makes money. I mean, you know, the major defense contractors / merchants of death, you know, the General Electrics, the Lockheed Martins, the Halliburtons, and so on. They made a major bonanza off of these wars, and that we have, you yourself have identified it as a military-industrial complex, this kind of machinery in place that capitalizes on war. And it very much runs against this sentiment of trying to get rid of war or aspire to a world without wars. So I'm wondering how one could go about, if they're serious about trying, if those of us who are serious, as you are, about putting an end to war, what can be done? I mean, it's got to be more complex than simply signing a petition and or maybe voting in somebody like Bernie Sanders. I mean, there's a whole machinery that has to be dismantled, is there not?
Well, first of all, we ought to be clear about the sort of militarist that Bernie Sanders is. He is a wonderful person on domestic issues. He is a horrendously militarized sociopath by global standards when it comes to support for the U.S. military, although being far better than Hillary Clinton or the other candidates. I think you're absolutely right. It's going to take more than an election. It's going to take more than a petition. It's going to take concerted nonviolent resistance and legal actions and non-legal actions and education and organizing and cultural change. And part of that education has got to be explaining to people that war is not actually beneficial. yes, there are a handful of individuals who get stinking rich and they see that short-term benefit as desirable. But when the nuclear war breaks out, they die too. When the climate becomes uninhabitable on this planet, and the military is the number one contributor to that, they have to live on the same planet. The damage that war does to a society, the moral damage, the impact on local policing, the local violence from veterans and from society as a whole that is learning violence from war. All of these things impact the whole society. And when people come to see that it's counterproductive, that all of the negative impacts and the cost of $1 trillion a year just from the United States alone and what's lost, what's traded off in wasting that money in that way, that's not weighed against anything good, that it's counterproductive. That the wars make us less safe rather than more safe, and that a long list of generals and directors of national intelligence and so forth blurt this out the moment they retire.
Okay.
That if Canada wanted to generate anti-Canadian terrorist networks on a U.S. scale, they would have to invest massively in invasions and occupations and drone wars around the world, as Russia is just beginning to do and just beginning to experience the blowback from the United States. You know, if you want to know how to make your country hated, and how to get your planes blown up, and how to generate hostility towards your country, the United States has got it down to a science. Eisenhower more or less warned of it over a half century ago. The wars are counterproductive. And when people start to understand that, and to understand that they are counterproductive economically as well, they are not what maintain what we think of as our privileged lifestyle, then I think it will become easier to engage in the mass actions that will end the thing.
Okay, before I let you go, David, I just wanted you to give our listeners a chance to hear a bit about maybe a bit of a preview of the updated version of your 2010 classic War is a Lie. Could you maybe give us a bit of a preview of what that is in that book when it comes out in April?
Yeah, it's intended as a handbook to prepare people for the coming propaganda, which is always coming every month at this point, a new pitch for a new war or a longer duration or an escalation of a war. And I go back and look at how wars have been sold to us and prolonged and beautified after the fact over the centuries and millennia in the United States and many other countries. And there are common themes and there are types of lies and they repeat themselves. And so I have updated the book with the past 5 years or so of trends in war lies around the globe, and looking in detail at some particular cases such as Libya and Syria and Iraq and the drones and so forth, in terms of which lies seem to be working less well or better with the public, and which on the other hand are succeeding in comparison to how they were used in the past, and so there are some cause for optimism. Some examples of the public in the United States and in other countries resisting war lies, but some disheartening reminders that war lies can sway people very easily. So lies about missiles into Syria in 2013 failed dramatically. Lies about Iran around the nuclear agreement in 2015 failed. But lies about ISIS and lies about Libya in different ways and with different techniques succeeded dramatically. So there is much work to be done in terms of preparing ourselves as a self-governing public to recognize the way we recognize in every other area, from transportation to healthcare to local city governance, when we're being lied to when it comes to war.
David Swanson, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with author, activist, and blogger David Swanson. He's director of worldbeyondwar.org and campaign coordinator for rootsaction.org. His website is davidswanson.org. An archive of Mr. Swanson's articles is available at the Global Research website. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. In what follows, we will be re-airing a repeat episode from November of last year as part of our alternative Remembrance Day programming. Stan Goff began his military service in January 1970 as an infantryman with the 173rd Airborne Brigade in Vietnam. His service took him to seven more conflict areas after Vietnam, and he is the author of the blog Chasin' Jesus. His latest book is Borderline, Reflections on War, Sex, and Church from Whip and Stock. Joshua Key, who hails out of Guthrie, Oklahoma, was trained as a U.S. combat engineer, was dispatched to Iraq in April of 2003. He fled the war for reasons of conscience at the end of 2003 and made his way across the border to Canada in early 2005. He has sought and been denied refugee status in that country. He, along with other Iraq war resistors and deserters, are quote-unquote living in limbo, waiting for deportation orders back to the U.S., where they face the prospect of dishonorable discharge and lengthy prison sentences for the crime of desertion. I decided to engage the two veterans on the topic of how and why the soldier had taken on an almost deified status within contemporary Western culture.
I actually wrote a fairly substantial chapter in my last book, the one that's coming out, I think, around February, about when this started in the United States in particular, and it was back then the Civil War. Before that, people were very suspicious even of standing armies. And the Civil War, the American Civil War, was the first modern war, the first total war in a lot of ways. It was the first mechanized war. It was the first time that supplies were being moved by trains and communication was over the wires. And the first aerial reconnaissance balloons, the first submarines, the first armored battleships, all those things, the first time that machine guns were put into use, even though they were put into general use because of the smoke back then. But there were all these things, and it was the first total war that was waged against the entire society. It was understood that the whole population was at war against another whole population. So in many ways, the American Civil War was the first modern total war. Another thing, a peculiar thing happened, and Harry Stout wrote Upon the Altar of the Nation. Upon the Altar of the Nation, it's a moral history of the Civil War. It's a very interesting book, because what he shows is that here, a couple hundred years after disestablishment, after there was the end of Christendom, the end of the political power of the Church in Euro-America, in Europe and America, there was the emergence of the nation state as the political sovereign. But and William Kavanaugh, a Catholic theologian, writes about this too. He called it the migration of the holy. What happened was the nation state in the Civil War became sacred. It became the civic religion. And it took on all the aspects of a religion. We had speeches that were dripping with religious imagery, and it's sort of interesting that if you think about going back to say the year 100, 200, 300 prior to the Constantinian shift in the church, the person who was most honored in Christianity was a martyr, someone who's willing to die, and willing to die for their faith. But with a civic religion, it's the person who's willing to die for their country. And that became not just willing to die for your country, but willing to kill for your country. And so that's, I think that underwrites the veneration of veterans, because there are plenty of people out there who take as many risks as veterans, more risk than most veterans have. There are plenty of people out there that suffer from traumas, trauma is as bad or worse than combat. There are plenty of people out there who contribute a lot more to society, but they're not venerated in the same way that veterans are. I mean, the reason that veterans are venerated that way is that the veneration of veterans becomes a veneration of war, and war is the fundamental organizing principle of the nation. So war becomes part of the national liturgy in this civic religion, and you see, it is almost an article of faith, and that's, I think, why there's this sense of sacredness about it. The sacrifice of the soldier becomes much greater than any other form of sacrifice, and there is an element of intimidation, and you're a heretic if you question this, if you don't participate in the veneration of veterans and the veneration of soldiers. You are an outcast because you're seen in exactly the same way as a heretic was seen in the High Middle Ages. I think that has a lot to do with it. This notion of a civic religion is really an interesting lens to kind of view this through, and it makes a lot more sense of why, you know, we have these parades and these flag wavings and all this. We want to refer to every soldier, even if they were a flute and piccolo player. And the Air Force band as heroes, you know, that's where I think this stuff comes from. Talk too long. I'm going to let Joshua jump in here.
Yeah, Joshua Key, you've gotten, I've seen online, there's a lot of angry commentary about you because you're a deserter. Yeah. And that's you're like a leper, unclean, as they say. You want to talk about those sorts of experiences. And does it surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me, but I
will. You used to think that way, though, didn't you?
Yes, and you know, I will never hide behind what I am. I am a deserter, and in a sense, I'm damn proud to be one. You know, people say, you know, well, how do you live with what you did? How do you do this? Well, I walked away from it. That's how I think half the mind that I have left, I have because I did say, got up and walked away. I look at the Veterans Day and the remembrance like it's a don't thank me for what the hell I did. Like when I first got off the plane in Atlanta, I got off, there was veterans lined on both sides. I still had my bloody DCUs from Iraq on. I put my head down and I walked as fast as I could because damn, don't sit and thank me for what I did. And I walked as fast as I possibly could to get through them people. Now, I look at it like I had an experience even on Remembrance Day. I go to a gas station here. I try to buy a juice, and the woman won't sell me a juice. And I said, why the hell won't you sell me this juice? And she goes, well, this is to honor the veterans. And I said, how the hell is that honoring the veterans? By not selling me a juice. And then the girl just said, well, obviously you just don't care. And I said, no, I'm a veteran, so answer the question. How does that honor me by you not selling me a juice? And then she goes, well, I'm just going to call the cops. And I said, well, call them, because I'll have the discussion with them of why you won't sell me your juice as being a veteran. But it's the problem is no one, it's all, remember the veterans, but remember what for? What's the whole scenario of what you're remembering, what you're honoring? You have no idea of what the hell you're even doing, except for it's just a day of honoring the veterans. What about the rest of the year?
You said that you're like in an earlier interview, you talked about one of your children came back from Remembrance Day. And what did he report back about the meaning of Remembrance Day?
Well, it was, I said, well, what did they teach you? And he said, well, they went and died for us. And I said, is that it? Is that all they taught you in being in kindergarten? Is that people went over and died for you? And, you know, I had to control myself when I went to school the next, because I was like, if that's all you're teaching my children, don't teach my damn children anything, because you're not teaching them nothing. But it was it's just, I guess it's in the society, right? You watch the news, you hear everything else. I mean, it's made to be a lot more, like I said, when's the day to remember all the deaths, civilian deaths? Because there's been a hell of a lot more civilians than what there's been of soldiers died. But, let's just forget about that and act like that's non-existent and doesn't exist. So it's shocking, in many ways to me. As far as the deserter and like I get all the time that I should be hung in town square. I just laugh at stuff like that because it's you might not call me a patriot, but I see myself in a patriot in many in different ways than what most would. I stood up, I walked away. I just recently have been in contact with soldiers that I fought with, and it's sort of neat to hear their perspective of when you left, this is what happened. But I'll never be, how would you put it, down or whichever on what I am. I'm happy to be the deserter, and I always will be. So,
Stan Goff, the social currents running through our society that tends to, basically shape us into a warfaring culture. I mean, we see it in school. We see it in church. We see it in popular entertainment and in sports. Do you think that these are things that are just deliberately, consciously conceived, or is it just sort of like a natural manifestation of this sort of like deep male sexual energies, the male violence? I mean, to what extent are these currents running through our society deliberately conceived to perpetuate this this religion of war and whatnot?
Well, ideology works in a peculiar way. It reproduces power at the same time that it conceals it. And the ideology of militarism is one that is now more concealed. It's very difficult to convince people that we're a militaristic culture, because now that's no longer acceptable to call it that, even though it is that, we can't call it that. So there's that concealment aspect. But if you go back to the turn of the century, around the time of the rise of the popularity of Theodore Roosevelt, and around that time, there was a real crisis of masculinity, because the frontier had been conquered. So there was no place else for this masculinity to be proven. And that was actually one of Roosevelt's things. You know, they were afraid that citification, that the urbanization was making men weak. And there was actually a call for militarism. That was also the time when the United States was very aggressively seeking colonies. And the Spanish-American War was their first attempt to really reach out beyond their own borders and begin to establish colonial peripheries. With that, in that period, we see the ideology of militarism really take a hold and being promoted. And two of the things that it was promoted through, very intentionally at the time, now it just becomes kind of a recursive feedback loop, and between the ideology and the culture. But at the time, this was very intentional. Was that were public schools were developed on a Prussian military model, and they were designed to discipline the population and make them more adaptable to a militaristic culture. And the other thing was the promotion of sports, in particular football. Now, when Jack Johnson defeated a white opponent in boxing, that Roosevelt actually called for the prohibition of boxing, because this was very much a white man's thing, this whole push to get through this crisis, or this so-called crisis of masculinity. But public schools were very definite. In fact, it was with the establishment of public schools, they also had military science, or what was then considered military science, which became ROTC, was integrated into the schools at the very beginning. And the whole administrative structure, the management structure, and the execution, the organization of classes themselves were all done on a military model that was adapted from Prussia. So it's been there all along, and do these things that were adapted from the military tend to promote an episteme of militarism? Of course they do. Whether we recognize it or not, because we tend not to understand sort of the interpretive frameworks that we use, because since they are our interpretive frameworks, they seem natural to us. They seem like common sense. And that naturalization is one of the things that sort of conceals ourselves from ourselves, the school and sport, definitely, and gun culture. After the Civil War, people became concerned that they had to fire 1,000 rounds to shoot one person. And so marksmanship became a big deal after that. And then an organization appeared to promote marksmanship that was very closely aligned with the military. It was called the National Rifle Association. And another thing, well, the NRA had another partnership at the turn of the century, and that was another organization that was designed to promote military virtues, and that was the Boy Scouts of America, which they actually adapted from the Boy Scouts of the United Kingdom. And they brought an advisor over from UK to help establish the Boy Scouts of America. So you had the NRA, you had the Boy Scouts, the NRA and the gun culture, you had Boy Scouts promoting involved militarism, you know, the same kinds of the uniforms and marching and earning awards and all that stuff was very militaristic, and football and public schools. So all those things together eventually became part of the culture, and these things, you know, again, ideology conceals power, but it also reproduces, and it started reproducing, it automatically reproduces those same virtues that are now identified as military virtues. And you know, I think that's it's very much in there, but it's not a conspiracy. It's just something that becomes self-organized. You know, society is a very complex thing, but it's also a thing that sort of runs under its own steam until something disrupts it. And so all these relationships become naturalized, and they end up setting up these same kinds of feedback loops between what we do and what we think and how we feel and how we understand things. And militarism is basically now in our social genetic code, for lack of a better analogy.
If we're being programmed to wage wars of domination, and with all the racial and other elements that go with that, how could that realistically be disrupted?
If I knew that, I'd be a really smart guy. Smarter than anybody else who's around right now, because a lot of people would love to know, how do we, whoever the we is, fix this, whatever this is, and I'm not altogether sure it can be fixed. It, I mean, my own little niche in all this, and trying to figure out how to intervene, how to deliver that dislocative jolt to people's consciousness about this is through the issue of gender, because I think gender is what underwrites militarism at a deeper psychological level, at a psychological level that is mostly invisible because these interpretive frameworks are naturalized. They are something that seem like common sense. I'm just not really sure. I think we just have to keep chipping away at this, you know, in every way we can, and confronting this in any way we can. And I'm not at all confident that we, whoever we is, are going to fix it. War seems to be a way of life all over the world, and it has been for a long time, and it definitely does correspond to two things, and that's large-scale organization and patriarchy of any kind. War seems to be synonymous with those things in the evolution of various cultures. And now with weapons being available all over the world, it makes it much easier for people to try to settle their problems with armed conflict. But again, it's also partly because we're organized all over the world now as nation states. Modern nation states have one fundamental organizing principle in common, and that is the ability to defend their fixed borders. So war or in the case of the more metropolitan nations, the ability to go beyond those borders and gain access to the inputs that they need in order to maintain a metropolitan way of life, which is done at the expense of global periphery. So it's built in. I mean, every time we start up our cars, every time, you know, we go to Walmart, every time we do, all of us are forced to be complicit because, again, the society is self-organized. We're forced to be complicit in myriad ways. But the question then becomes, how do we find ways to withdraw step by step from our own complicity? And I'm not sure I have an answer for that beyond local solutions, because it seems like the big global problems have such mass and inertia now that even world leaders are only pretending to be in control. I think they themselves are captured by this inertia. And I'm just not sure. I'm not sure if there is like a magic wand we can wave over this and make it all go away. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I do is just try to appeal to people one person at a time. Men in particular, that's my little shtick, is men in particular, take a look at yourselves and see how many ways you're motivated by this probative masculinity that associates masculinity with violence and conquest. If we can get men to think more about that, then at least some men will learn how to not participate in those structures. And I think that's probably the best we can hope for in a civil rights.
Mm. Would you counsel people to just sort of turn their backs on a lot of popular entertainment? I mean, you mentioned the sports like football, but also your game, some of these electronic games and just about everything that's on television. There's usually some subtle messages reinforcing those masculine, quote-unquote, virtues.
Yeah, I think probably more valuable than turning a back on them would be for people who engage in more astute cultural criticism. Because these, you go and look at one of these Cinema Nines or whatever, and seven out of the nine films will have a man with a gun and a fireball in the background up on the marquee. I mean, this is very much a cultural thing. But since we're going to be exposed to it anyway, we need to be exposed to it in a way that we learn how to be critical about it. And cultural criticism is very, very important. Susan Jeffords wrote an essay some years ago, back at the beginning of the Iraq War, called Telling the War Story. And she showed how by turning these things into stories about individuals, we can avoid looking at the larger structural issues that reproduce war. Right now, the war is not something that is being produced for the same reasons now as it was 2,000 years ago. It's a different structure that's reproducing war. It's a different kind of war. So we don't want to essentialize war, and then put it beyond our critical intervention. But by turning it into a story about individuals, this one, I forget what the name of it is, The Last Survivor or something that came out recently, was full of pathos, because it was about this titanic struggle of this one individual to get through this terrible ordeal, and it made him very heroic. But by pulling our focus onto that war story, where we have the pathos of the individual character inside a story, it redirects our attention away from the structural conditions. It redirects our attention away from why was this person here in the first place. What are the underlying historical trajectories that underwrite the war? Why did the United States feel like it had to invade Iraq? Why have we shifted since the Cold War all our attention to Southwest Asia and China? Why is all that stuff going on? People start asking those questions. Then power can be in trouble, or a little more trouble than they're in right now, because then we begin to see what their true motives are. And I think that's the main thing that's concealed by ideology, the true motives and the true reasons for why things are the way they are.
Yeah, you speak to a kind of media literacy. I was just sort of thinking about maybe busting myself a little bit, because I remember in my youth watching Raiders of the Lost Ark, and there was this scene where there's this ethnic gentleman, I wasn't quite sure where he was from, but he wasn't obviously American, and he was waving this sword around in this really intricate way, and then Indiana Jones just sort of casually pulls out his gun and shoots him, and the crowd just erupted in laughter. I guess we have to kind of deconstruct those sorts of reactions.
Exactly, and that's it. I would like to see a constant and relentless deconstruction of just one particular genre of film, and that's the male revenge fantasy. It's the most insidious genre, in my opinion, and it's probably one of the most popular. But the male revenge fantasy if every time a male revenge fantasy came out, we had an explosion of cultural criticism and an explosion of deconstruction around what was going on with that, I think it would open people's eyes. Why do we as an audience participate in it? Why do we cheer when Indiana Jones shoots the guy with the sword and casually walks away as if this man's life is worth nothing at all? Why does that become comic relief, you know, for the tension in the film? Why is that? And that deconstruction would be very helpful.
I wish that I knew the answer as well, but the only thing I know to do is to do what I do, and that's to speak about it and to let people know and to continue that. I know that, like what you said with the video games, I had a we were raised as brothers. We were cousins. He joined the Army, would have been about 8 years ago. When he first joined, he called me. I was already in Canada. He goes, oh, don't worry about it, brother. It'll be like a video game. And I said, what the hell? What do you mean it's going to? You have no idea. It ain't like no damn video game. And then, of course, 3 years ago, he gets three of his limbs blown off in Afghanistan. And, talking to him on the phone, he said, well, brother, it wasn't like a video game. And I said, well, yeah, you don't go get a health packet and all of a sudden your damn arms and your leg come back on. But that was really his, that's what he said. And I was a veteran already on the run living in Canada. And that was, it'll be like a video game. And I think that's a very big problem of the desensitizing people of this is what war's going to be like. This is how it's going to be. This is how you're going to do it. You'll just play a video game and then your actual experiences will be like the video game. And that's complete and utter bullshit. But I think that there definitely should be more something with video games to be less the fantasy of what war is going to be and more reality.
Joshua, your situation is pretty critical. There's been a rash of deportation orders going out over the last couple of months, and if you go back to the United States, you have an understanding of what kind of penalty you would pay?
Yes. With contact with lawyers and trying to work things out, you know, I've been told I could plea bargain for around 30 years in prison because of writing the book and doing the things that I've done since I've been in Canada. I just sort of, how would you put it? I'm a soldier, always will be, so I always have plan A, B, and C in the back of my mind and always will. But it definitely is a crucial for all of us in Canada who came here. And myself, I came here just to live in peace. That's all I wanted. I didn't want nothing else. I don't ask for anything. I don't live off the government. I don't do anything. The only thing I do
is can't.
I have to take care of my children the best I can. I put one foot in front of the other every day like any other human being does. And I'm a man in an unbelievable situation, an unbelievable story, but definitely I will overcome one way or the other.
Okay. And I suppose I should say, just as a matter of full disclosure, that the two of us have been working together and I've helped fundraise on your behalf.
Stan Goff served with the U.S. Army between 1970 and 1996. He writes the blog chasingjesus.blogspot.com. Joshua Key is an Iraq War deserter and author of The Deserter's Tale, the story of an ordinary soldier who walked away from the war in Iraq. Information on Joshua and other U.S. war resistors in Canada can be found on the website www.resistors.ca. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.